Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Just last week, US President Donald Trump hosted a lengthy call with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to discuss sensitive issues such as a potential ceasefire in the Ukraine war. In these calls, though, the leaders communicate via an interpreter, and interpreters play a crucial role in high-level multilingual meetings like these. So how do they work in such high-pressure situations? Well, Richard Simcott is a polyglot who has studied over 50 languages, and he joins me now. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you for being with us. You've been described as one of the UK's most multilingual people, and having studied up to 50 languages is a lot by anyone's standards, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's obviously, you know, when you come to studying things in depth and going into so much detail with a number of languages, the numbers don't mean so much. Really, what we're talking about is languages that are often very much related. So languages from the same families, you know, the Romance languages, the Germanic languages, and the Slavic languages have really been my main focus. But once you've added those together, you're already pushing quite high numbers before you even start looking at any languages outside of that.
So listen, of the 50 languages then, I've read you say that you use about 15 regularly and 30 then over the course of a year. Is that still the case?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, it's not, you know, exactly mathematics when it comes to this kind of thing, but yeah, roughly. I mean, I grew up speaking English, obviously, at home, but then later when I was older and I'd been through university and married my wife and I speak Macedonian together, for example. And then with my daughter, I grew up speaking French, German, Spanish with me as well. So We had a multilingual household. And then outside the house in Skopje, we would always use Turkish, Albanian. And then we'd go to Greece quite often, speak Greek. And in Bulgaria, I'd switch over to Bulgarian, and Serbia to Serbian. So very quickly, these numbers sort of rack up. And then you'd have sort of work-related languages like your German, French, Scandinavian languages, other Slavic languages like Polish or Czech, whatever, where I need to use, whether it was just for reading or for using to speak to people, however that was, I would be using quite a number over the course of a year.
And how hard is the switch? You know, when you're having to switch between those languages, what's it like?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, actually. I really cut my teeth on the whole switching thing when I was working in customer services and technical support many, many years ago after university. I was taking calls in around 8 languages regularly, and the phone would come up and it would say Switzerland, and I'd have to guess which language it would be. So I'd say something, you know, I'd say bonjour, or I'd say guten Tag, or whatever, and you could almost guarantee that it was going to be the wrong one, and an Italian voice would pop up, and I'd have to switch immediately into the other language. Or it would say Italy, for example, and everyone expects it to be Italian, right?
Yes.
But no. Sometimes you get a call from Italy and you've got the Italian code, and then they say Grüß Gott in German, which is hello, because it's calling from South Tyrol.
So you're making your adjustment pretty quickly in those instances.
Yeah. So
then,
absolutely.
I mean, as I said at the beginning, I mean, what we really wanted to talk to you is about those high-level interpretation, interpreter jobs, where there is so much at stake and you absolutely have to get it right. I mean, the pressure must be immense.
Oh, yeah, the pressure is, for those people, absolutely enormous. I mean, you're talking about things that you see in the news happening. So you're very aware of, you know, the wrong word or the wrong reaction or the wrong way of phrasing something could become an international incident, and people's lives sometimes are in the balance when you have that kind of issue. So yeah, I mean, it's extremely high pressured and not something that I think any of the interpreters that do that kind of job take lightly. But it's not always in their hands either, because it depends on whether or not note takers are allowed, whether they then use the notes to then go back, depends on the setup. So every leader will also have their own preferences as to how they use these. The interpreter's job really is to represent faithfully what's being said in the room.
And if you're translating something, is your job to translate word for word, or do you have to do a bit of a cultural nuance translation as well, Richard?
Well, I mean, you know, if we take a thing like you know, Irish and English. I mean, you get these turns of phrase that are used in Ireland so that you wouldn't use in, say, the UK, you know, with, you know, what kind of thing someone's got on them or at them. And they're things that are from the Irish language translated into Hiberno English, but can only really be understood fully in the context of Irish English. Well, if you imagine that, you know, 10 times more over an international sort of where people don't have that access to the cultural or other linguistic links, it makes it even more complicated. So a direct translation won't always work. And also the cultural reference points won't always work because what's said in one context might not be something that's said in another.
And if I'm sitting in a room and I'm the interpreter for somebody who's sitting beside me and someone on a video link says something that is very offensive, are you prepared to translate that directly, even though the person who's being insulted is sitting right beside you? You have to, I suppose, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, they have to represent faithfully what's being said. I mean, you know, there's one thing to make slight adjustments to allow the message to still be given without it being completely garbled because of cultural or linguistic issues, because of the way the message is phrased. But it's a completely different thing to change the message entirely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if something's being said, that's the message. And yeah, whether it's nice or not, interpreters will have to do that. And, you know, you can imagine during the Cold War, during trips to China with the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration, they've had teams of interpreters so that they don't have to rely just on one person, them getting tired, them getting stressed, them getting just, you know, too heavily put on.
So how do you feel then about us mere mortals when it comes to linguistics, learning a language on the apps? There are lots of new ones out at the moment. Do they work, do you think?
I think there's only one thing that really works, and that's a desire to learn and to allow that language to become part of your life. I mean, if you are just relying on a couple of hours a week, unfortunately, it's not going to cut it in a very short time. In the longer term, maybe you might edge your way forward in the language, but it's going to be quite slow progress, and the chances are that you're going to give up at some point. Whereas if you are able to actually, you know, give yourself realistic goals and set yourself a realistic amount of time to be able to achieve those goals, then you're going to have success. It's usually having contact with the language, I would say, on a daily basis if you want the best results.
Mm-hmm. And you gave Irish a go during lockdown. How was that?
I have. Tommy Fulham, Gilga, Mish.
Very good.
My Tarsha Rule Yacker.
My gosh, you've got an accent there and everything, Richard. It's going very well.
Yeah, Tommy Mahoney in Skopje, Nish, I guess. Chenil, yeah, Gilga, and Valia, sure.
That's amazing. Yeah. In comparison to the other languages you've studied, what was Irish like?
It's tough because, as I say, you know, you can't really use it so much here in the Balkans, as you can imagine. But I absolutely love it. I mean, at the moment, my Irish is getting a little bit mixed up with my Scottish Gaelic because I've been kind of fluctuating between the two and enjoying both. Mm-hmm. But my focus has been until this year on Cornish. And so I sat all of the Cornish exams and I finished that, and now I sit on the terminology panel for the Cornish language and absolutely love it. But yeah, Celtic languages are my kind of new focus. They were my plan for my retirement, but COVID happened and I was like, okay, why not start now?
Yeah, it's just an extraordinary thing to be so proficient at and so interested in. I mean, have there been any studies? Have you found anything to explain why you're the person who can learn 50 languages?
I think it's the same thing because, you know, people you get at home who love football or love any sport and they're able to memorize all of the, you know, the league tables, the different names of the clubs, the different players for each club. And they know all of this at such a level because they're genuinely interested in it. Mm-hmm. They see the world through the context of what they're interested in. For me, that's language. So, you know, when I see the name of a place, like I see Derry and then I say Dora in Irish, and then I learned that word actually is like oak forest, and that's where the word Derry comes from. And then I'll learn that in Cornish, Derio is the word for oaks as well, oak trees. So you see this link, this common Celtic link, and this is how my brain sort of goes out really from there. Everything I look at, I see in the context of how it links together the bridges that we have between the languages and the cultures and people, and how it really adds colour to our world.
Richard, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much, Richard Simcott there. Gurv míle maith agat agus slán go fóill, Richard.
Oh, gurv maith agat, slán go fóill.